This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need.
And this is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be with you till 2 p.m. I've been doing this program for 10 years now. This is the next to last program. At the end of every year, sometime in December, I've gotten in the habit of calling what I sometimes call our readers panel, John Dederich, Allison Jones Famato, and Cameron Cobden, to talk about their favorite books of the year. This time, in the middle of the summer, I've asked them to talk about their favorite books of the last decade, the books that they most enjoyed reading in the time that Booktown has been on the air. I spoke with John and Allison a couple of weeks ago. Cameron, who is 7 months pregnant, wasn't able to come up that day, so we talked on the phone a week or so later. And first I'm going to see what John and Allison have to say, then Cameron will follow in a little bit. We did agree that we enjoyed doing this so much that we'll probably continue the process every December. Since Booktown won't be on the air at that time, we'll probably just post our discussions on the Booktown blog, which you can get by going to kvmr.org and going to the Booktown link, or you can go to booktown.blogspot.com. In either case, the discussion should be there, and other bookish things, interviews, short essays, and the like will probably be there as well. I started by asking John Dederich what books he'd most liked, then we went on to Allison Jones Famato.
Well, why don't, I have 10 books that I'll mention, and I think I'll just mention them first and then maybe read from a couple and talk about them. So, my favorite books that I've read this century are Atonement by Ian McEwan, An Instance of the Finger Post by Ian Pearce, Sacred Hunger by Barry Answorth, and another Barry Answorth novel, The Song of the Kings, The Botany of Desire, My One Nonfiction Choice by Michael Pollan, which I find infinitely superior to his big hit, Omnivore's Dilemma, Quincunx by Charles Palliser, a very difficult and interesting book, Middlesex, Geoffrey Eumenides, one of those names, I forget.
Eugenides,
that's right. Eumenides is something else entirely, speaking of Aeschylus. And the book I chose by David Mitchell, I chose Ghostwritten as opposed to Number Nine Dream, because I know you think Number Nine Dream is all about Murakami.
Well,
it's an homage. It's totally an homage. Yeah.
I thought that Number Nine Dream started out, he couldn't decide if he wanted to write like Nabokov or Murakami.
Yeah.
And I was glad he wound up Murakami.
Yeah.
But it still, I think, was a little derivative. But of course, your favorite of those, I think, is Cloud Atlas.
Yes.
Yeah,
Cloud Atlas
say,
is just
mine.
A stunning book.
Which I finally read and quite enjoyed.
It's a wonderful book. And then I have two books by Margaret Atwood, Oryx and Crake, and The Year of the Flood, which is they're fabulous. It's a totally believable post-apocalyptic world, and they're companion books, not really a sequel. It's they're part of parallel volumes.
Now, I'd like to, just from having looked at the things you have in your pile, it struck me before you started talking that in one sense or another, they're almost all historical novels, although the history might be the future.
Right, that's right, sure, exactly. Yeah, the Oryx and Crake, that's true. I mean, I didn't even think of it that way, but they're all historical with the exception of the two sort of dystopian Margaret Atwood books.
But that's a history, it's just not one we've experienced
that's
yet.
That's right. And of course, Botany of Desire is a history of four plants.
Right.
You know, it looks at four, and I'm sure I've talked about it before, looks at four plants, but that's a he's a popular author and he gets a lot of press. But I'd like to talk. And Atonement is just such a beautifully written book and a very an adequate film made of it that I thought was very well done, very well acted. A couple of unfortunate cuts made in it. The trek of the wounded soldier across northern France to Dunkirk does not fare well in the movie, whereas in the book it's one of the most exciting passages.
I think it's the high point of the book, and in some ways it's not really necessary. We don't want to tell the audience why it may or may not belong there. The book could have been totally adequate without it. It's not necessary for the plot, but I think it's the high point of all the writing.
I think so, too. I really had that feeling. What else did I want to talk? Oh, the Quincunx. You know, I wrote a review of the Quincunx. This is going way back, and I couldn't believe it. I pulled this novel off the shelf. This is a truly Dickensian novel. Actually, it's more Wilkie Collins-esque than it is Dickensian, but it's that same period. And it's extraordinary in its... Well, let me just read what I wrote all these many years ago. Quincunx by Charles Palliser was published in 1989. This is an extraordinary, well-plotted novel set in early 19th century England. It is a mystery of epic scope, but this work of great literary merit transcends classification as a genre novel, either as a mystery or as historical fiction. It's a richly detailed study of practically every aspect of English life, high and low, town and country, fair and foul. It's an astonishing, thorough examination of every facet of English social life, et cetera, et cetera. It's really about corruption, about moral taint, and how even the purest, given the right circumstance, can turn. And it's a very long book, 900 pages or something. But
and little print.
yeah, really, it's dense, but it really held me. It really held me for the full read. And something else that I just was completely captivated by.
Before you get to that, I'll just say of these books you've mentioned, I've read a couple of them, and the Quincunx I have. But
you've read it? Did you read the Quincunx?
I haven't read yet, and I'm really looking forward to it.
I think it's stellar. And then Tom Taylor and George Cloud were after me for years to read Sacred Hunger by Barry Unsworth. And I like Barry Unsworth. I first discovered him in reading Morality Play, which I really enjoyed. And I read Rage of the Vulture, which is really a very good book as well. But Sacred Hunger is one of the best books I've ever read. It won the Booker Prize, not that prize winning means that much. But the Booker generally is a pretty solid indication, so just a short list of books that are worth paying attention to. This is a book about the slave trade. And again, it's about moral corruption and how that taints people who are associated with it. And then someone attempts to right that wrong and sort of expiate that sin. And it becomes a utopian fantasy novel at a certain level. The writing is lucid. Unsworth is a stylist. I would compare him to Ian McEwan and Margaret Atwood in the sense that all their novels have a different voice. It's not as though, you know, you can read Murakami, you can read various other authors, and there's that stamp, oh, I recognize this prose style, I know who this is. Dickens, for example. But you read somebody like Unsworth or Margaret Atwood, every book has a voice which is associated with that particular book. And so I really admire that kind of writer, and Unsworth is like that. I wanted to read this passage. The ship is just leaving the coast of West Africa, having loaded up with its latest human cargo. It's a slave trader. In the cover of darkness, as quietly as possible, the Liverpool merchant began to steer a course southeastward. But when the ship met the deep sea swell, the rhythm of her movement changed, and the people in the cramped and fetid darkness of the hold, understanding that they had lost all hope of returning to their homes, set up a great cry of desolation and despair that carried over the water to the other ships in the road, and the slaves in the hulls of the ships heard it and answered with wild shouts and screams, so that for people lying awake in villages along the shore and for solitary fishermen up before dawn, there was a period when the night resounded with the echoes of lamentation. It's a really beautifully written book. It's a tragic story. It's a wonderful story. I really highly recommend this to anybody who wants a really solid read. It's really involving and really questions so many things that you're going to find. I really have a great fondness for also this other book, Incense of the Finger Post, which I loved it so much that I went on and did a lot more research about the English Civil War, because it's really about the immediate aftermath of the English Civil War. And, of course, you know, it being the English Civil War, it's given... I bet there may be one high school student in 10,000 who's even aware that they had an English Civil War in the 17th century, or knows anything about Charles I, Charles II, or the Cromwells. And my own, and I'm interested in it. I've been ashamed to say this for many years. My friend Michael Kilker used to really tease me about this, because I'm a direct descendant of Oliver Cromwell, which is nothing to be proud of, because I think he was a rogue, scoundrel, and murderous dog, but that's just one man's opinion. But he's family, so I can talk about him. And Killigrew was an issue for Michael Killigrew because his direct descendant, Sir Thomas Killigrew, was a great foe. He was a courtier, and he and Cromwell actually met in battle. So genetically, he and I had this ancient warfare that we had karma to work out, I guess. But anyway, Incident of the Finger Post was so involving that I did a lot of reading about the English Civil War, a great prose nonfiction book called The World Upside Down, World Turned Upside Down, which is a great history of the many factions. It wasn't just courtiers and Puritans at all. There were all this, the ranters and the diggers and all these other factions who were striving for really religious and political expression that erupted in England in the 1640s. And struggled for, if not preeminence, or at least some foothold in the society throughout the 1650s, and of course, were crushed ultimately by the opposing forces of the Puritan, the parliamentary government, and then later by the return of Charles II, when everything was sort of brought back to normal somewhat. But it's a fascinating book. It's part of that trend that one has seen in recent literature over some time there, of the multiple narrator novel. You know, it's rare anymore to pick up a book where there's one voice. You know,
it is.
Yeah, have you noticed that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is one of those four different narratives, and it's Rashomon-like. It reminded me of Akutagawa in the sense of that basically the four voices are talking about the same events. And, of course, everybody has his or her own truth. One of the people who narrates is a liar, so you have a totally unreliable narrator.
I love that.
But everybody works their own story into this narrative in a way that makes them look good. It's really a marvelous book. I really recommend it. And if you want to know really, and this is so important, you know, we're not disconnected from that time. You know, we are the direct descendants of these people. So many of us. Puritan and courtier alike, and so much of realpolitik that I think still lingers today comes from the 17th century. It's a tremendously vital period. I really, really recommend it. And there's an element of the mystical in this book. There's an element of strangeness. There's bloody warfare. There's retribution. There's sin and expiation. It's really...
And a wonderful really heroine.
And a great heroine. A great heroine. Yes, if you like heroic women, this is the book for you.
Now, I read this on your recommendation and totally enjoyed it. And I don't know if it's in my top 10, but certainly in my top 20 of the list.
Yeah.
And it might be in the top 10. I haven't quite decided.
Sure. Well, you know, how do you choose? It's hard.
After that, though, you were selling some books, and one of them was another book of his, The Dream of Scipio.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Which is much, much shorter and covers a different angle. It covers similar events of racial and religious prejudice and persecution from the 3rd century to the middle of the 20th century. And very short compared to this, maybe 200 pages,
right.
But also very good.
Very compelling book. And I just finished the newest Ian Pearce novel, which is called Stones Fall. And it's, again, multiple narrators. And it really is prescient in the sense that it really covers finance. It's about banking. It's about banking and arms dealing leading to potential crash. Any of this sound familiar? But it's primarily in 1890. And it's about the lead up to World War I. It's about you know, the amorality of the arms trade, arming both sides, which is something the United States does extremely well, which England needs to do. Very, very good book. Not quite as gripping to me as Instance of the Finger Post, but worth a read. That's Stone's Fall by Ian Pierce. Let's talk about Margaret Atwood, who is why she hasn't gotten the Nobel Prize yet is a mystery to me, because she certainly deserves it. I mean, she certainly has been at the top of her game for a long time. I don't think she's ever written a bad book, and I've tried to read just about everything that she's written. And I don't know why she... I don't know... I mean, I like Toni Morrison, but I think Margaret Atwood is a far more compelling reader and a much more user-friendly reader in many ways. Although, I don't want to take anything away from Toni Morrison, who I think is also just brilliant. But there are other authors who've received the Nobel Prize for very slim oeuvre compared to Margaret Atwood. And Oryx and Crake and The Year of the Flood really deal with very believable future with sort of untrammeled corporate exploitation of genetic manipulation and frankenfood, for example, and manipulation of genes in animals, experiments going awry, things escaping into the greater environment, into the whole ecosystem of the planet, leading to an extraordinary rapid decline of human life, part of which is intentional, as someone intends to sort of repopulate the world with the genetically modified people according to his own design. That's what Oryx and Crake is about. And then you see the consequences of that so much in Year of the Flood. And it's very interesting in that the two books are about the same period, but someone who's a very minor character in one book becomes a major character in the other, and vice versa. And that's kind of fun. In fact, I read Oryx and Crake as soon as it came out. A Year of the Flood was out this past year. When I read it, then I immediately had to reread Oryx and Crake, which was immensely rewarding and just lots of fun. She's great. You're a Margaret Atwood fan.
Yeah, I think she's just a really stunning writer, and I agree with you. Her voice is unique in every book, which is really rare in
an
author.
Yeah, it's
and,
really rare.
And everything she's written is compelling, it's fascinating, it's well written. You know, she's just a really stunning writer, and I just don't think she really gets her due in this country.
I think that's true.
And I have to repeat what I've said several times, that I liked the first book of hers so much, which was...
Surfacing,
which was in her own voice and is very personal, that I've never really wanted to hear one of her other voices. I just... That as a personal novel, that's as intimate and direct as you can get, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And all of her other ones since then have been personas. And I'm going to have to try her personas.
You should try one on, Eric. I think you'd really enjoy it, because I think you'd appreciate literary quality, and she's just really knows how to craft.
Yeah, she writes literature.
Yeah.
Which, you know, frankly, isn't getting published much these days.
No.
And it's really, you know, great when you get to read fine literature.
Yeah. That transcends whatever phony genre classification you want to hang on it.
Right.
So, Allison, you're jumping in?
I'm jumping in. I'll do as John did. I'll read off the titles I picked and then talk about some of them. My first is Plain Song by Kent Harouf, Speed of Light by Elizabeth Rosner, City of Thieves by David Benioff, which I think I talked about maybe 2 years ago, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, Jonathan Safran Foer, Rules of Four Old Men Waiting by Peter Pouncey, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime by Mark Haddon.
Great book.
And Samaritan by Richard Price. And then I have two memoirs in here, The Tender Bar by J.R. Moringer and The Hemingway Book Club of Kosovo. And it was really hard to do this, to pick books, to narrow it down to favorites. And I kind of looked at the books that still were sticking with me after so many years.
Because I think because of your job, you actually read a great deal more than either John or I.
Yes.
At a certain period, you were writing reviews as a part of the staff of the bookseller. You were writing reviews for the Union.
And right. I think when I went back and looked, and I luckily had a lot of them still, I reviewed, gosh, over 3 years, you know, 10 books every 2 weeks. So I had quite a few. And that
don't you sleep?
Well, you know, there were times where I didn't read quite all of them. Other staff members would, but I read an awful lot. Now that I'm not working there, I actually have more time to read. But I still tended to go back a ways in my reading. I'm not thrilled generally with what's being published right now. The kind of stuff I really love to read just isn't making it out to the stores. So I tended to go back. And my first one is Plain Song by Kent Harouf. This is just one of those books that is so beautiful. It's a little bit rough edge. It's set on the eastern Colorado plains, and it features a high school teacher named Tom Guthrie. He has a wife who either can't or won't get out of bed, two bachelor brothers who don't know much about the world beyond their own little farm gate, a pregnant 17-year-old girl who has no place to live, and various other people in this town. It's just a slice of life book, but his writing is just really fine. It's one of the most descriptive books I've ever read, but it's also one of the sparsest. He uses very, very few words and really conveys a sense of place and a sense of character and a wonderful story. I picked up a book that came out several years after this, came into the bookseller as an advanced reading copy and just had basically a wallpaper cover on it. So no information whatsoever. I picked it up and started reading and went, oh no, it's a sequel. I hate sequels to books I love. But I have to say, Eventide, the sequel to Plain Song, is also a really excellent book. He took the best of what he had and he didn't mess with it and he didn't try to get cute. He just continued with a story. And it's just one of those books that is quite lovely. Speed of Light by Elizabeth Rosner. She's a Berkeley writer, and this came into our store probably about 12 years ago. I kind of fudged on this one. And it's a story that has just really struck with me. It's three characters who are really burdened by their separate fears of the world, and they're trapped by memories, some of which belong to their parent. The siblings are children of a Holocaust survivor. They're a brother and sister, and the sister's housekeeper is a survivor of a Holocaust in her native village in Central America. And for them, the past is always with them, and the brother will not leave his apartment, and he is a scientist, and it kind of goes into all of these little scientific things, but turn out to be lovely metaphors. It's a book that not always easy to read in terms of the tragedies that have befallen these people and how damaged they are, but how they all work through it in their own way, and sometimes just little baby steps where what we don't consider the great finale that happens in so many books, where the great transformation happens. This is all very, very small, but really well worth reading.
I read a later book of hers, Blue Nude, which I thought was extremely well written, but maybe hampered by its framework.
I agree.
The structure, if she didn't really let herself go, she sort of decided, this is how these elements are going to fit together, and they did, but...
Yeah, I felt it wasn't nearly as successful a book. Speed of Light is her first novel. She is a poet, and I felt it was a very poetic book. But her two subsequent novels I didn't find nearly as successful. City of Thieves is by David Benioff. He's a screenwriter, and in times I could see that in this book, but I just enjoyed it so much that I didn't care. It takes place during the Siege of Leningrad, where a 17-year-old boy who has been caught stealing is brought before the authorities, and he believes he's going to be killed, and with him is a deserter, also in the same situation, and rather than being shot, they are told by the colonel that if they can go out and find a dozen eggs for his daughter's wedding cake, they will be spared. But to do so, they have to go beyond the lines of the city. It doesn't gloss over the horrors of war and the horrors of starvation, but it's a very, very funny book. And I kind of found myself at a loss. How can this horrible situation have this much humor in it? But life does. And I just think he really found it. It's based on his own grandfather's experiences in Leningrad during the war. I'm sure the situation didn't happen to him, but he writes as though it does. I just got back from New York a couple days ago, and one of my favorite books, post 9/11 books, is Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close by Jonathan Safran Foer. And it's a very sad and funny book. It's very original. It takes place with a 10-year-old boy whose father has been killed at 9/11 and finds a key ring in one of his pockets as he's going through his closet. And he wants to find out what this key fits. And he searches New York by various clues that he finds with his father's thing. This child is somewhat of a savant, probably has Asperger's, doesn't quite fit into any one place or thing. You know, he's just kind of a loner of a kid. But it's his story of healing and how he comes about it. And it's just really a great read for people who love both New York, but even if you've never been there, it's just really interesting.
Now, it's interesting that both this and The Curious Incident of the Dog and the Light have very similar heroes.
They do.
Although I think this one is a little more vivid.
Yes.
And I wish that Foer had just stuck with him, and there is a subplot with the grandfather that I've already somewhat
I
wish he just ignored that completely and just stuck with the boy.
Because this boy is just a fascinating character. And as he's looking for doors that will fit this key, he doesn't take them in any logical order. You know, he doesn't work his way through Brooklyn to Manhattan. He hopscotches all over the city, and he's quite a great character.
He also wrote Everything is Illuminated.
Yes.
The same author. Because the similar themes of sort of, you know, working through the mystery of an object to find a kind of liberation is also a big issue in Everything is Illuminated.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Which I haven't read, but I know some people prefer Everything is Illuminated.
Yeah. I like them both very much. This one just kind of spoke to me because there's so much came out after 9/11 that just didn't cut it at all.
Well, it was exploitative is what it was.
It was terribly. And this is a book that really worked. Being a post 9/11 book without really talking about 9/11.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Rules for Old Men Waiting by Peter Pouncey was one of my favorite books in the last few years. It was written by Robert MacIver. Oh, no, he's the main character, excuse me. Peter Pouncey is a professor emeritus in history at Columbia, and his main character, Robert MacIver, is an 80-something-year-old historian who's living out his last days, and he makes a list of rules as he is waiting to die. This is Pouncey's only novel. It is just really well-written. It's very short. It's very sparse. But one of MacIver's rules is that every morning he will do something. He will tell a story from its beginning to the end. So he has a story within the novel about three British soldiers in the trenches of World War I. And you're seeing it crafted. You're seeing him writing it and editing it and going forward and going back. And it's just told in such a really moving and compassionate way. And then I picked a couple memoirs. I am mostly a fiction reader. I really do love biography and memoir especially. And I love to read memoirs by people you've never heard of. The Tender Bar by J.R. Moeinger, he was a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist. And he grew up in New York, Long Island. 142 steps away from the Dickens, which is a derelict watering hole there. And he's been abandoned by his father at a fairly young age. His dad was a DJ, and he refers to him only as the voice because that's how he knows him. He'll find his voice on the radio. But he's pretty much raised by the hard-drinking regulars
at this bar, and they are his family. And it's a kid who's pretty damaged. He feels he needs to take care of his mother, and he lives with mother and aunts. It's all women. And how he grows up and gets over his issues of having to be the one to make everything all right. And the other memoir I picked was the Hemingway Book Club of Kosovo by Paula Huntley. She was a Bay Area author. She went with her husband, who was a law professor at McGeorge in Sacramento, to Kosovo. He was there to help work on their legal, rework their legal system, which was in shambles after the war. And she took a job teaching English. And this is her relationship with her students. She finds a copy of An Old Man and the Sea and Xeroxes it, and they read it together. And it is very much a metaphor for their own lives, the loneliness and the struggles that they have living there. It's a very moving book. It's full of hope and inspiration and forgiveness of these people who have had genocide happen to them. They're living in abject poverty. At one moment, she's invited to a student's home for dinner, and she goes and meets the family, and they all sit and watch her eat because there is no food for them. And the struggle that she has, where she wants to share it all with them, but knows that their pride is to serve her this meal. And she sits there and eats every bite on her plate as they watch her. Gosh. It's just, we cannot relate to this kind of a world, yet it's happening all over. Mm-hmm. And so it's a book I really recommend reading, because it's just, you know, a very ordinary person doing very ordinary things, but making a difference. And well, we can talk about some more. You mentioned, one of the ones I picked was Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime by Mark Haddon, and Eric mentioned that it does have a narrator very much like the boy in Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. He's autistic. The neighbor's dog has been killed, and he is going to solve this mystery. He's got a great voice. This book was actually written for teenagers and was a young adult book in England. But when it came to the States, originally was packaged as a young adult book, was not successful, and repackaged for adults.
I think it takes a certain degree of sophistication to understand the voice and understand, and I could see why it would be the case.
Right.
Although I've had bright high school kids love this book.
I think a high school kid who can hear that voice and under the just the patter of his voice and the rhythm of it, and if you can start hearing that in your head, then it really works. And it's just a really good read. I love how emotional this book is, without the character evoking any emotion. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really successful thing. Samaritan by Richard Price. This is probably it's the most contemporary feeling of the books I chose. Richard Price is a gritty writer from the New Jersey area. He wrote for the television show The Wire. His main character here is a former TV writer who's come back to where he grew up in New Jersey in the projects, and he's going to make a difference in the lives of the kids who grew up here. And instead, he's nearly beaten to death one night, but yet he's unwilling to name his assailant. And one of his high school friends, a female detective, is there to help him heal, both physically and emotionally, but she wants to solve this and wants to know why he won't talk. And it's very gripping. He is a very, very edgy writer. He's a dark writer. He wrote the book Clockers and a few other mm-hmm. things that have been, that also just have this really dark edge to them. And I find his writing very, very compelling. And another book, this is a historical fiction called Easter Island. It's by Jennifer Vanderbees. And this is the story of two women from very different eras whose stories parallel one another on the this island off the coast of Chile. The first is a woman who arrives on Easter Island in 1913 with her anthropologist husband and a very troubled sister. And he is looking for clues to the history of the people for the island. And then 60 years later, a botanist is drawn there also, and she is trying to figure out why there's no fauna there, or flora, excuse me. There's no plant life in Easter Island. And so she's doing all of these experiments, and their stories start to parallel one another, and then they start to weave together. And I read this book a long time ago, and it's one that I just pops into my head periodically that I really, really enjoy.
Now, John, you wanted to add something.
I just thought I just wanted to mention the second Barry Unsworth novel. I don't want to let that go without mentioning. That's Song of the Kings.
Yes.
Did you read that?
I did.
Wonderful book.
I think he's great.
And anybody who loves anything Greek or historical, he does. If you know Euripides, if you're familiar with his plays, there are the two plays, Iphigenia at Aulis and Iphigenia at Tauris, and they're variants of the same myth. And this is about Troy. This is about the sacrifice of Iphigenia, the daughter of Agamemnon, so the wind will come up and the boats can sail to Troy and loot and pillage and plunder and do all that. That's Iphigenia at Aulis and Iphigenia, and she, of course, is then sacrificed. But in Tauris, she escapes and magically is transferred to this other island where she's reunited with her brother Orestes, and it's da-da-da. He does an amazing thing in Song of the Kings where he bridges those two stories. He takes the mythic variants and makes them a single tale in a way that's really credible, that really works. And his characters, Agamemnon and Menelaus and Helen and all those who are central so much to the Greek mythos, he makes very credibly human. And it's just marvelous. It's just, you don't have to know anything about Greece or anything about this to appreciate this. But the more you know, just as in anything, reading anything historical, the more you know, the richer it is when it's well done and accurate. And I just, it's and fun and short and fast. And again, Unsworth is a stylist, and it has a very, very, not slick, but polished and smooth kind of reading style. It's good.
And I want to add, John mentioned Atonement, and when he mentioned it a few years ago on your program, Eric, we had this conversation. It's one of my favorites, and I knew he was going to talk about it, so I didn't put it on my list. But it's a book that people would come in our store and say, oh, you know, I've tried reading it, and it's really hard. When I would sell it to people, I would say, you need to sit down when you have an hour and a half to read and start it that way. Mm-hmm. It's not an easy book
to get into.
It doesn't have that gripping first paragraph or chapter, but it is just one of the best things I've ever read.
I
encourage people, if you've picked it up and put it down, you know, pick it up again.
But it grips you soon enough.
Oh, absolutely.
I agree with you, though, that you have to sort of bear with it a little bit. And then when it starts to turn on you, you go, oh,
you're
my
so sucked
God.
Into
yes.
it. But you just need time to let it kind of soak into your psyche, because mm-hmm. it really is such a compelling, lovely story.
And don't worry that you don't know how to pronounce the girl's name.
No.
Bryony. Yeah. But when I read that, I went back and I've read everything Ian McEwan mm-hmm. has written. And I will continue to do so.
Absolutely. I haven't read his new one, Solar, but...
I just finished it.
Oh, you did?
It was fun. It's closer to Amsterdam than any of the books in that it's funny. You know, Amsterdam, which won the Booker Prize again, is funny, funny, funny. Solar is funny. And it's, boy, does he have the right sort of take on political correctness and... no one escapes. There's a certain kind of level of political satire, social satire in the book that's really funny and very timely and will undoubtedly offend somebody. But, you know, some people are worth offending. It's a wonderful book. It's really, really very funny.
That was a conversation I taped a few weeks ago with John Dederich and Allison Jones-Pomato about their favorite books of the last decade. A week or so later, I caught up with Cameron Coppin, and this is what she had to say. So, Cameron, what were the favorite books you read in the last 10 years? And I know that you haven't been reading much recently, but I was amazed.
Yeah, we'll take the last 2 years off a little bit. But I have actually managed to read a couple of very good books in the last couple of years, one of which was an early recommendation from John Dederich, Cloud Atlas, which I loved. And I think that's one of my top books for the last decade. I know that he had a lot to say about it in one of the earlier programs, but I feel that that book does so much with exploration of genre and playing with the notion of speculative fiction and science fiction and different styles and the continuity of character, even when that character changes into other characters. There are sort of aspects of things you might have found in Orlando in there and things that talk about historical fiction moving forward into sort of realism fiction and moving forward into science fiction or what Margaret Atwood likes to call speculative fiction when she doesn't want to be called a science fiction writer. I think David Mitchell does a beautiful job of blending several different books into one book seamlessly.
Now, I finally got around to reading it this year and quite enjoyed it, and I must say it was quite unlike what I had expected, and I don't think it would spoil anything if we just told a little bit about the way it's structured, because it's very ingenious, and you catch on after maybe the third section how it's going to go.
Well, and I think that the key to the whole book is the idea of the musical piece that is referenced. It's very much a sort of a concerto. It has movements which all harken back to each other. There is a theme that spreads its way through all of the stories, and all of the characters, all of the main characters are one character, essentially.
Yeah.
But the shifts are very different.
I'll just say it starts as the record, the log of a lawyer who's going to the South Pacific, and his return from the South Pacific Island to Hawaii and then San Francisco and the horrible things that are happening to him. The second section involves the composer you're talking about. I think it's the second section.
Yes, the wonderfully dissipated composer in the 1920s, I believe.
Right. And somewhere along the way, he comes upon part of this log and he refers to it, then that suddenly breaks off and it goes to another story which refers back to the composer, then another story which refers back to the third. They come to a climax and then it suddenly, somehow it happens that all these stories that had been incomplete, people find how they end, and in the second half of the book, it's sort of like a crescendo and decrescendo and you wind up back with the original character.
And it's wonderful to see how each of the characters going from piece to piece has doubts about the previous character. They're so clearly related, and they also react with some level of suspicion about the authenticity of the stories coming before them.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that really interesting. It's almost like a running gag.
Right.
But a very, very well-crafted joke. It reminds me, that also kind of brings to mind Italo Calvino and the best parts of If on a Winter's Night a Traveler.
Right.
It is a puzzle book for an English major. So
okay.
That was one of my very favorites. And it again, I mentioned Margaret Atwood because I know John Dederich also talks to some extent about Oryx and Crake, and I wanted to bring up the Penelope ad and some of her poetry, too. She really, I think, has hit a new stride in this last decade with her writing. She's one of my favorite authors. I recall one of my professors in college, Kofi Owusu, used to speak of Toni Morrison as the author who could do no wrong. And I think for a lot of readers, we have that author, that person where we really look forward to the next thing that person does. And for me, Margaret Atwood is certainly one of those. And I really loved Oryx and Crake. And even more than that, I love the Penelope ad. Because it takes on this challenge of a very well-known myth, the myth of Penelope waiting for Odysseus to return from the Trojan Wars, and gives her a voice that, you know, is only suggested by the situation of her mythology, being a cousin of Helen of Troy, being related to all of these epic characters, and her portion of the epic has always simply been waiting and weaving. And the description of how that life could be interpreted, as Margaret Atwood puts forward, is so good and so poetic. I really enjoyed that book. It's a very small book. It's a very slender book, but so dense and rich in its mastery of the language and myth and sort of modern interpretation of what domestic women have going on in their heads. I thought that was a wonderful thing.
Which is something you're discovering.
Yes. You know, being a mom, it changes some perspective. But with the Penelope ad, you know, she's got her one son, but her primary preoccupation is holding on to this life that she has as her own, while also waiting for the life that she was supposed to have with her husband and as the ruler of this community. So that was one of the great surprises of the last decade in terms of reading. It's such a little book, but it's so very, very well done. And I was caught by her term speculative fiction when I was reading criticism of Oryx and Craig. She resisted the term science fiction as it applied to some of her writing with regard to The Handmaid's Tale and Oryx and Craig and others, but has recently decided that it's okay to call her work science fiction. It frightened her, I think, initially to be characterized along the same sorts of things as Star Wars or Star Trek, but it's something that I think there have been a lot of writers in the last few years who've really taken on sort of this genre-bending task. And with her, she does it so beautifully that it really brings out what's best about science fiction. And I think David Mitchell, again, did that very well in Cloud Atlas in the future-looking portions of the book.
Yeah, I would say that the people who are a little more at home in the genre tend to maybe distinguish space opera, sword and sorcery, and speculative fiction.
And I think that it's wrong to simply keep them in their boxes. Sometimes it's very useful to go in and say, unpack the box and find out how you can use it, use these things that you find in fantasy and in sword and sorcery and in magical fiction, and put them together in a way that's new and fresh and challenges the reader and really respects the reader, because, you know, readers, for the most part, I think, want to see something new and interesting and exciting, something that challenges them and brings up new thoughts, which is one of the things I thought that it would be a mistake to leave any conversation about the last decade in fiction without discussing Harry Potter.
Good point. Excellent point.
I think that is probably the biggest literary event of the last 10 years. Certainly a very popular series, but as distinguished from some of the other big-selling, best-selling books, like Dan Brown's work and the Twilight series, I find that Harry Potter is one of the most readable series ever. It may be this generation's Chronicles of Narnia. The hero epic that is presented in that book is done so, or in those books, is so very well crafted, not just for Harry, but for the one that I find the hero in my mind, Severus Snape. I think he's one of the greatest characters I've ever read in literature. And I find that J.K. Rowling really put together a book and a series of books in a way that respects all of her readers, from young to old. The narrative sweep of it is not just wish fulfillment. It's not just fantasy. There's characters that have depth and reality. They're intellectually and emotionally consistent, and they grow with the reader in ways that are surprising and also very satisfying. And I think that it's that what she's done is very, very admirable for what is also a huge blockbuster. It's really encouraged reading for many, many people, young and old, school-aged children to people who haven't read since school. And I think that's great. I think it's wonderful. I don't have the same kind of reaction to things like Dan Brown's books or to Stephanie Meyer, who is certainly enjoying a great deal of success. I don't know that those will have the kind of lasting power that I suspect we'll see with Harry Potter.
We've only got a couple more minutes. What else is on your list?
Well, I wanted to mention Jose Saramago, who just died on the 18th. And here's a man who gave one of my favorite books, of course not one of the last decade, but Blindness is an incredibly powerful book and one that I think many, many people should read. I think it should be required reading for thinking people. And I think that his take on the challenges of being a human, of being a thinking person, of living within a community, of dealing with the challenges of culture and personal feeling and being part of the sweep of history and part of the sweep of the present are just so fascinating. And the language, though it is in translation, he was of course Portuguese, but the language of his fiction is so beautiful. And the intimacy of Blindness is something that was so compelling to me. Another thing that was very surprising and also very satisfying for a reader who likes to be challenged but also likes to be transported is a beautiful, beautiful book. And all of his writing, The Cave, Death at Intervals, sometimes Death with Interruptions, but beautiful writings, a really interesting perspective on the world, and another writer who really hit his stride after the age of 60. Someone who came to this with a very different perspective and provides a window on a world that you might not otherwise find in a lot of literature. So I wanted to make mention of him because he's another one of those authors where I just feel he could do no wrong with a pen.
And I have yet to read him.
Oh, well, do it.
I just didn't know where. And you think Blindness is the place to start?
I think Blindness is his best. It is a really wonderful book. And again, it falls into that category of what Margaret Atwood would call speculative fiction.
Any others?
Well, I think Life of Pi was a fantastic book in the last decade. It's one of the few books that I have gone back and read again because it was so interesting and so creative. It's almost allegorical, the story of this boy on the boat with a tiger. It has aspects of myth and fantasy and fable to it. The characters in it are so interesting. The one thing about Life of Pi that I would have changed is to, you know, cut off the last 10 pages and leave the reader with the story before the author decided to kind of help the reader to interpret it.
Or wrap it up.
And then map it out a little more. I didn't like that part, but the rest of the book was so interesting and very suspenseful in its rich literary way. I loved that book a lot. And City of Thieves is another fantastic book that I know Alison Tomato has discussed to some extent, so I will leave that. But that also features one of the great characters that I have read in the last 10 years.
That was Cameron Cobden talking about her favorite books of the last decade. Before that, we heard the other members of Booktown's readers panel, John Dederich and Alison Jones Pomato. And as I said, we'll probably continue this series of discussions every December somewhere online, certainly at booktown.blogspot. So check that out if you have the chance or if you're so inclined. 2 weeks from now is the last Booktown program. I hope to come full circle and discuss some of the same topics, maybe even some of the same books, maybe some of the same people as in the first program in August of 2001. Stay tuned now for Jimmy Accardi's Rock and Roll Party.